Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by Vihau Adobaisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of Leading Corporate Transformation, the Vihau podcast, powered by PwC. I'm your host, Serdar Özcan, and as always, I'm joined by the rock star of corporate podcasts, Corey from PwC. Together, we'll be bringing you the latest insights on corporate transformation.
Hey, Serdar, thanks for this warm welcome. Haven't heard this for a while, but it's a pleasure. Hello, everybody. Hello, listeners. It's good to be back. It's Gori again, Gori von Hirschhausen, the co-host of the podcast. As you know, I'm the transformation consultant in this talk. I do lead our industry sector consulting at PwC Germany. And with this background, I'm here to, of course, ask the questions around how companies optimize their organization, how they reinvent their business model, etc. Today is a special moment in our podcast series because we are now switching gears. We are turning to the investor piece of the game. And I'm very happy to have a private equity partner with us who will speak about the industry, who will speak about his personal career. And he has a lot to say, especially in these times. And I'm very honored, and we are very honored that we have today with us Dr. Sven Oleovnik from Emram. Sven, over to you.
Yeah, hello. Happy to join your team as a rock star, probably. Thanks so much. So let me maybe briefly introduce myself or Emram. I'm Sven Oleovnik. I'm now for 2.5 years with Emram. Before that, I was heading another private equity firm named GIMF here in Munich, so basically heading their German office. But after doing a deal together with Emram, we reminded that we have been already studied and experienced university together. And so I decided, or we jointly decided together with the deal, we invested jointly in SofaTutor to try together again. Yeah. And so I moved 2.5 years ago to Emram, and here now I'm a partner. Emram is a private equity investor. It's not public listed. It's just privately held. We are having funds. We are investing out of these funds as a so-called growth buyout investor. What does this mean? We are investing in three sectors. You can, if you want to dive deeper, I don't want to bore you now here in our podcast. You can go on our website to get a better understanding. So just briefly, we are investing in three sectors. It's mainly IT, tech, and software, non-discretionary consumer, and services businesses. And the companies should have 3, 4, 5 million of EBITDA. It depends a bit on the growth rate. We should be able to invest into majorities, starting with equity tickets for maybe 15 up to 50, can go bigger even together with other partners and co-investors. But what's important for us that I call it always blood and soul of the business plan should be on board, being ambitious to bring the company to the next level. And this is basically what being a growth buyout investor means.
Looking at the fund size of Emram, what is the size?
The size of the first fund was 400.
Okay.
So basically there was 350 and we did a so-called top up of 50 again. So it summed up to 400. And we are now at the end of the fundraising of our second fund, which will be slightly bigger, but we are up to closing it. So I can't really be that transparent, but given the current sentiment in the market, we are super happy that we have been able to raise a significant amount and that we are able to, let's say, have full firepower and being fully operational. And this results even in a super cool performance in not only in terms of numbers, but even in terms of deals. Because we, in the last 6 weeks, so within 6 weeks, we've been able to do three new investments. So in a new fund, we have four new investments already, which is still up to closing. And so deployment goes well. Pipeline is super good. We are able to invest very selectively in very attractive companies. And very ambitious and cool teams we are able to support.
Well, that's great. So congratulations on your fundraising performance. We are going to dig into what makes your fund, previous fund, very successful, obviously. But let me just start from elsewhere. What's happening in the world of private equity at the moment?
What's happening at the moment? You can read it in the press, I would say, but we can try to go a bit deeper even to get you a better understanding what's currently happening. So I would, in principle, say private equity is still a super attractive asset class for all investors. And private equity is still a super attractive partner for management teams to wherever bring they want to bring their company. So the market is still very well working. Of course, we have some external factors. It's not only about what happens in the Ukraine, what's the impact on our economy, what is happening with the future election in the US, and all this kind of stuff. It's even a bit, let's say, the story is also about the asset allocation of investors per se in this given sentiment and environment. And this is the reason why a lot of private equity firms are at least struggling to raise new funds. And we have a kind of consolidation process at the moment, which we can see. Therefore, we feel ourselves in a very good position because we had a very good performance. So investors are trusting us, are giving us money again. And therefore, we are able to invest. And I strongly believe that the few ones who are able to being operational and able to invest at the moment will become even stronger in the future and gain additional market share.
So just to clarify for our listeners, when you are talking about private equity world, are you covering large cap, mega cap, small cap, mid cap, or are you particularly focused on a particular segment?
So we are covering smaller, as I stated before, starting at 3 to 5 million in terms of EBITDA and 15 million. This is so-called smaller mid cap market we are covering. And in Germany, the smaller mid-cap marketing is super attractive because you have a lot of the so-called famous German Mittelstand in the different sectors. So this is
so the environment you've characterized applies particularly to the small to mid-cap.
This I cannot tell you how what are the issues of the large cap funds. Of course, because this is a completely different market. I know that investments in, for example, so-called special situations, restructurings, stuff like that, are doing very well and are very much requested. I know also that a lot of funds investing in infrastructure, energy, whatever, of course, it's a bit the talk of the town at the moment. So, of course, within the private equity industry, you have a segmentation. Some of them are growing faster. Some of this are maybe suffering under, like venture capital, are suffering from a pushback at the moment.
Sven, you gave a good, let's say, overview on the current environment in which you operate. Looking at the investment opportunities, how is the situation here?
So what I can tell you is if you look at the market, we, I guess, have 8 times more deal flow than we have experienced 5 years before. This is really a fantastic development for us. I guess this is because we at least were able to make M&A advisor mainly to understand much better what we are standing for, what kind of assets we are looking at, and in which areas we want to invest. And this brings us into a position which, as I stated already before, to invest much more selectively, and since we have specialized more on these growth buyout segment, so fully focused on a segment we already had from the very beginning, but we have shaped our focus even a bit better, and we are able to create better angles how to bring the company to the next level. So this is not only about finding the right deals, this is even about convincing shareholders and managers that we are the right partner for these people for their future ambitions to bring the company to the next level. And it's not, and sometimes M&A advisors I don't want to blame them, but for them, it's pretty clear that they just want to do a deal. And once they have, we have signed at the notary, they send the bill, and then for them, the story's gone. They create a nice tombstone and send it around and celebrate closing dinner.
A virtual tombstone.
And this is the moment when the work for us really starts.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is a kind of, let's say, marriage. We are then together for 4, 5, 6, sometimes even more years. Sometimes the environment changes. And I think we're going to talk about this even a bit later. Therefore, you have to have a very good idea, a very trust. We must trust each other that you can bring the company then back on track and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's indeed. And we became much better in this field, in this area.
Okay, just to link back to what you said, you know, we are seeing a lot of great deals. Could you explain what makes a great deal for you?
A great deal is basically a company which is performing very good above the market average in terms of revenue growth and profitability. A company which has a at least partially very good team, as I said, blood and soul of the business plan. And you see how the management team, of course, sometimes people need to be added, the organization needs to grow as well, but at least you can see a very well-educated and ambitious management team, how they want to bring the company to the next level and how we can develop a joint understanding, how we can cooperate and how we can support them. So there must be a kind of a fit. And if this fits, we make up our mind, if this is a deal we really want to invest, and we jointly believe that we can really make a successful story out of it.
So how do you assess that fit?
Oh, well, this is...
that's the magic. That's the secret.
That's the secret. No. At the end of the day, you can analyze a company from the different angles. Famous commercial due diligence, financial due diligence, famous, I don't know what else you need to do. And this is all, let's say, the hygiene factors. But then you need to develop a kind of a feeling. Who are the people behind? How do they behave? What drives them? How do they behave when critical points are coming up? Are they putting their money where their mouth is? Do they have not only skin in the game because we just want to be secure, but do we get the feeling that we are fully aligned in how to develop the company and how to support them, how to work together? Is there trust and belief in each other? Do they trust us in a way that if they want to address a critical point, they are addressing this point very transparently, openly, and proactively? It's not that we are, and they don't give us the feeling, oh, they are the dump investor guys showing up from Munich once in a while, and now we somehow need to entertain them because we have a new board meeting. But that we are sharing our experiences and that we are raising, nobody has the perfect answer on different aspects, but it must be allowed that everybody who has something to say is willing and motivated to add that, and that it is respected. Even if an intern has a good idea, why shouldn't we respect this and take it and just create something out of it?
But just to get this straight, this means you encourage the management to invest as well?
Yes.
How does it look like?
It looks like it depends a bit on the individual situation. For example, if you have an entrepreneur who was already, we had this case now recently, for example, we invested in a company called ProVital, active in the pet food mm-hmm. environment. Mm-hmm. So this basically, the company was sold off by the former owner of the company.
Yeah.
He managed the company very successfully. And basically we asked him and he wanted to sell the company because he wanted to secure his succession. He's in the mid 50s, and he said, well, there's even a life after that. And Depending a bit on the partner I'm finding, I'm ready to reinvest an amount which we need to discuss. And we convinced him to invest 25% of his proceeds to reinvest into the company. Mm-hmm. So, and 25% is a decent amount, of course. And this is one part of the story. The other part of the story is that when you have managers who cannot afford to buy 25% or so because they're just lacking the money, here the question about transparency and trust begins, because we then need to discuss how much can you invest, what's reasonable, because we want them, these people, to being motivated, to have, to be aligned, to, but we don't want to stress them that they cannot sleep anymore in the night when some problems arise. So they should have skin in the game, but they shouldn't, let's say, ruin themselves if things go south. And we are offering them a system where they can invest whatever they can do. And we are leveraging their amount in different structures, being sweat equity, being sweat equity. And we structure them normally via straight equity and shareholder loans to get them to a significant shareholding amount as a basis. And then, of course, they will get calls once they have succeeded in a way that certain IRR hurdles or thresholds have been achieved, so they can get additional calls in order to still improve their proceeds.
All right.
At exit.
Why don't we then talk about your magic formula? What makes Emeram a very successful private equity investor? How do you add value to your portfolio companies that, say, your competitors relatively do not?
Yeah, and maybe there's an example from your investment portfolio, like Boards and More, or a company that you can take as an example.
So, no, well, basically we have created six columns. We see ourselves as a business development partner. A business development partner means basically we have defined six columns and playbooks how we are supporting our portfolio companies. The first one is about strategy. We are jointly defining where and how to play. This means not only regions, sales channels, products, offerings, prices, whatever you can sum up in strategy. Second point is organization. When, for example, whatever field you are active in, sometimes it's even worse because you have a strong customer concentration. So whenever you promise to deliver, you have to deliver. And this means the organization needs to be able, it's not that the revenue is growing and the organization is always lagging behind. The organization needs always be behind the revenue growth, because sooner or later, otherwise, the engine is always driving in the red zone, and sooner or later the engine will break up. And therefore, we are trying to discuss together with the management what brings us in the position, what kind of organization brings us in the position, processes and procedures to be able to deliver whatever is needed in the future. And so the organization must normally be, let's say, 6 months, 1 year in front of the revenue plans to be able to do so. The third one is digitalization. How can we support our companies in bringing in additional experience via digitalization, improving the processes while growing? And HR is important. Governance is important. And ESG is important. We see ESG as a value driver. And on all these aspects, we are defining, once we have invested, a so-called 100-day plan. 100-day plan does not necessarily mean it's all finished within 100 days. It means that within the first 100 days, and if it's 180 days, it's even the same, we create a joint idea how to develop the company, where we want to bring the company within the next 5 years. So we are defining this plan within the first 3 months, let's say. And so to get a joint understanding about budgets, prioritization, how can we support? Is it add-on where we can support? Is it HR where we can support? Is it whatever it takes. Yeah. And this creates a kind of a working plan, which we are going to, let's say, which gives us an orientation and even a kind of internal benchmark. Where are we? Do we need to change? Do we need to, how can we proceed? How we can we improve? And this is even it's not only about the plan. It's not only about the transparency. It's the joint understanding is basically freeing up the all discussions from disappointments, from misunderstandings, because you have everything is clear on the table. It's a big incentive to talk about topics proactively. And there's basically less room for misunderstandings and for undermining the necessary trust in how we work together. So it's not that we want to have full transparency about the company, how the company is operating, because we don't trust the management. It's more that we have full transparency because we don't want to talk about this kind of stuff about transparency. We want to, it gives them and it brings them definitely in a situation where they can be much more open, because we have been able to see things early enough. They are able to talk about important topics early enough. And so we can get to a new plan, a new idea, a new budget, whatever is necessary, even early enough. And everybody of us knows that no business plan turns into reality once it is written. It's only a tool to be able to discuss in a structured way what were our ideas, what went well, what went not so well, and how can we improve in a very incremental and a day-to-day basis, and not once in a while to throw in a bomb and to see, oh, this went wrong, so we need to kick out the management. No, it's a matter of, it's a tool how to improve, let's say, the working situation.
I mean, this sounds very interesting, the way how you work as a business development partner. What are the biggest challenges you normally face, and how do you deal with them when it comes to this approach? Because I can imagine that management, of course, gets a closer alignment with the investor, and the investor is taking care and asking many, many questions. That's what we learn. You want to understand how the mechanic of, or how the machine works, basically. And you are very close to management. And this is a challenge for management, because it, of course, brings them to a next level of speed, right? So what are the biggest challenges?
Yeah, it brings them to a next level of speed. But so first of all, this is a very challenging idea and in a very elaborated toolbox. And what you need to understand is, on what everybody needs to understand, there's a phase of onboarding, I would say. Mm-hmm. We always say einrütteln. I don't know how to translate it in English. So, and this is a process. You really need to get acquainted to each other. This takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of discussions, maybe sometimes a dinner, and certain events, how you are able to prove that you are a supporter and not a controller. And of course, the management needs to understand that they are steering the company, mm-hmm. and they are responsible for it. Mm-hmm. And we are just sparring partner. We are not steering the company. And sometimes, and this is a very tiny road sometimes, because sometimes manager believe, oh, they are now showing up again. We are discussing the strategy. They are adding ideas how to structure a workshop. And so they sometimes think, oh, we now can lean back and be entertained, or even worse, we are just executors, which they aren't. We are supporters. They are executors. They need to bring the ideas. They need to deliver. They need to discuss transparency, what they can do, what they cannot do, and where they might face some issues, and how they can ask for support. And then we do everything which is necessary to support them, but we are not steering the company. And getting acquainted to this kind of, let's say, working together, which is a very intense one, joint collaboration. This takes some time.
But you expect performance, you expect results, you expect impact from the management. You are, as an investor, looking at this very, very straight, right?
Yeah, we expect, of course, performance. Yeah. But we help them even to achieve these kind of performances. Okay. So what we are doing, for example, and this is our ideal situation. If you invest into a company, I don't know, doing 50, just to give an example, which does maybe 50 million in terms of revenues, has a headquarter, is active only in Germany. And then you do for the first time an add-on, which needs to be integrated. Then you are going to expand the company internationally. Then you add a new business unit, whatever it is. And the company grows from 50 to 150 million turnover. It's a completely different game. We, for example, experienced that we had a company which was basically headquartered here in Germany, and we globalized it. So within a bunch of few years, they were active all around the globe. So they were not anymore able to just go next door and ask a colleague how we are going to do this or that, because there was a time gap of 6 hours, and you need to get organized. You need to substitute a kind of ad hoc organization to via process and procedure management tools. And this is a complete different culture and a complete different skill set. And we are discussing this. We are discussing with the management, if this is the strategy and we want to become an international company and we want to grow via, I don't know, 10 add-on acquisitions, which we indeed did, then we believe, and this is our experience, the skill set changes from this to that direction. And are you willing to do that? Or are you probably better not... Are you the right CEO for the company, or are you probably a better chairman because you are full of inspiration, but you're not a manager, day-to-day manager. You are bored in getting, you get bored, you are bored out one if you have to motivate on a day-to-day basis people from, I don't know, in operations. Yeah. And you cannot any longer deliver the thousands ideas from which only 50 take into reality and materialize. So, and this is, we talk about where, and this is where trust and belief kicks really in. It's not about the numbers. Oh, we have promised you to grow by 20% and now we achieved only 15. Are you disappointed? No, that's not the point. Yeah? Yeah. It's more about these topics I just mentioned. And then you are able to be successful. This is when you are really able to be, if you are in a position, you can discuss about these critical topics, which have impact on the individual, on the roles of the individual contributors to the success of the company, then this makes it really successful.
What is the primary source of tension between the management team and the investor team in your case, other than perhaps the perception that there is sort of, you know, too hands-on engagement?
I'm not sure if there's a primary source of tension, to be honest. For example, what I personally, and this was in another case, I'm not talking about Emerald. What I, for example, experienced was that when you are going basically to discuss about the reinvestment and the role of the management and successions and bad and good lever clauses, and then you are diving down in very awkward details. And then it can happen that this is not creating the desired joint platform. It's creating, it creates a kind of potential misunderstanding, which makes the onboarding process even longer and harder. And then it can happen that, for example, the co-investor who is still running the company believes that you want to kick him out because you want to improve your returns. You want to pay him his, I don't know, earn out or whatever it is. This could create tensions. And why and this is maybe not a super good example, but I'm trying to explain that the source of tensions is either you are not 100% aligned, or you were not able to create a platform where at least everybody has the feeling that you are 100% aligned. People are trying to overpromise because they don't understand that they don't do a deal, that the first deal is not the final deal. it's the beginning of a joint journey to then do even a much better deal, because we are, our ambition is to make a company not only 2 times bigger, but even 2 times better, and to bring the company even valuation wise to the next level. And so the first deal must be a good one, but the joint journey creates much more value. And this is the reason why we need to be able to set up this kind of platform, and to be really fully aligned. And here you can do a lot of mistakes. And then when you are working together for such a long times, it's damn sure that critical topics may come up. Markets are changing. Look at the Corona crisis. You need to be then able to basically, sit together and make up your mind and get things done. Just solve the issues. And therefore you need, and this is even, and maybe we talk about the role of investors and even the education, you said it before, and this is even raising the question about, are we just financial, is this financial services industry? Yes. But it's also a kind of consultancy. So investment is much more than just being active in the financial services industry.
I mean, there's always this comparison between family-owned businesses and private equity, and it's like the pros and cons, and there's always, you know, this certain tension behind these discussions often. We talked before about this, and you had this this prominent saying that there is the right investor for a company at a certain point in time. Can you tell us a little bit what you mean by this, and what does it mean if you compare private equity to family-owned businesses?
I would say there is no special structure which is very much creating problems or creating value. If you look, there is, it's not a given situation that a family-owned business will be successful forever. Yeah. Because there are a lot of family, there are very, a lot of good examples for very successful family-owned businesses, even over generations. But there are very good examples for really great failures, yeah. Because, I don't know, the third generation, some are interested in dividends, the other investment in investments. So they are not aligned any longer. And whenever this alignment is suffering, whenever, there is no, how to say, a company needs to be, at the end of the day, needs to be successful. Otherwise, it will not be able to grow. It will not be able to pay dividends. It will not be able to create value. It will not be able to attract talented people, and so on and so forth. So there, for example, if there is a very successful entrepreneur and he looks for a successor, then it's often very hard to attract the best talented people, because top tier one managers, they say, oh, I'm not going to make my future career depending on the, I don't know, day-to-day mood of the entrepreneur, because I probably want to do things differently. And this all very often doesn't work out. And so finding the right successor for a company which is 100% owned by an owner, by the founder, is much more difficult than when there is a more, let's say, a kind of a calibrating shareholder, like a private equity investor on board, who is basically balancing a bit these kind of, let's say, emotions and decisions. So secondly, private equity, if you look, then there's different surveys, even from the BVK, was able to create more growth, to create more new jobs, and to create more wealth than public listed companies and family owned businesses. Of course, you can say, okay, there's a kind of pre-selection effect and stuff like that. But at least it's not that, it's just not the case that private equity is, because we need always to look who is the next owner. And who is when we are going to sell, who is then believing in the next phase of the company. And due diligence processes are now so much into the details that you are at the end of the day not able to let's say, dress up the company and to sell it if there is no real value behind. So you can sell a company at a decent price only if you find somebody who is believing, and for good reasons believing, in the future of this specific asset. And this is one of the reasons why I earlier mentioned, for certain situations, and certain situations means we are able to supply a company with the money, we are able to supply companies with the right skill set, we are an attractive partner for tier one management and motivated people. We can bring a lot of know-how at the table, which some other companies simply can't, because they don't have access to this vast experience. And then when it comes to a certain size, once the company has been growing from, let's say, 50 to 200 million probably, then they maybe have a better new owner, because the next private equity fund who has a mid-cap player and then a large-cap player, and this is a certain, it's just a question about the life cycle, or somebody who can add value because he's active in Southeast Asia or whatsoever, in a different region where the company wants to grow, where we are not with ourselves present and stuff like that. It always depends a bit on the situation.
Excellent. So I want to focus on governance for a second. So you're investing in a company that kind of gives you board seats, I presume. How does governance in the world of private equity look like?
So in our world, it's quite easy. We are the major shareholder. As I stated before, we want to support the management, and this is what we are doing. But if we see that thing we are not able to develop together with the people who are our co-investors or who are managing the company, if we see that things go not in the right direction, we need to take action. And this is what we do.
Do you bring external board members?
Yes, of course.
Those companies?
Yeah, yeah. This
and
is,
how do you select them? Or what are your criteria, your considerations in general?
So we normally, in the situations I, for example, I mentioned before, we had a former owner of Provital. He reinvested 25%. We invest 75%. We agreed without he was asking for it, that he is going to have a board seat, we are going to have a board seat, and we are going to have a kind of a neutral member, as probably even as a chairman, or Beiratsvorsitzender, chairman is a strong word, as a Beirat, advising basically and calibrating, sometimes even being able to calibrate the different views and adding, of course, value. And in this case, we are still in a kind of a negotiation phase, because Provital is a multi-level marketing company. We are trying to get somebody in whom we know very well, who is experienced in this, very well experienced in this specific market field, because we want to support the company in with this business model, and we want to bring in know-how a company needs to have when it further grows. When it gets more, when it internationalizes, and this guy is super experienced in this environment. So it depends a bit on the situation. In this case, for us, it was very important to understand that this specific person we want to add has experience in this specific sector. There might be other situations, for example, Boards and More. We have a very well trusted colleague, Ralf Püttmann, who is heading the supervisory board. We are working with him for many, many years. He's super experienced in the wider space of consumer products, and he has an affection for digital processes, for getting close to the client. And this is supporting the Boards and More, who is a B2B2C company in getting, the best of all worlds, remaining a B2B2C company, but getting closer to the end customer. We want to just understand better what the consumer needs are to be able, for example, to develop other products and to get inspiration for our innovation processes out of it, for example.
So we talked about Provital. Maybe there's another prominent investment for Emram, which is DivaE. Can you talk a little bit about this one? Because you just de-invested from DivaE.
We just signed the deal. Yeah, we are in the process of closing. But DivaE is indeed a very interesting company indeed a very interesting investment case. And the reason is... it's basically a service company, and I don't want to bore you with too many details, but the idea from the very beginning was in the digitalization services sector. At these times, you could see a lot of many very specialized services companies. And they addressed a specific topic and always talked, for example, to the head of marketing, to the head of sales, to the head of logistics, to the head of finance, to whomever. But they were never talking to the CEO. How can digital processes, digitalization, how is this impacting a whole company? How is this impacting strategy? And how can they be able to get up to this kind of level? And so we basically we met at the beginning. We met just a consultant. It was Tilman Auer, who had the idea to bring together a bunch of companies who were complementary to each other. But in being complementary, they were able to support, to basically bring a new offer to the market. And in doing so, to make the step up from talking just to a tier two management, to the client at the tier two management level, to talk to the CEO. And support these guys then in improving their strategy and their, let's say, more global processes. So, and what we did is basically we bought five companies in one signing. We brought them together because we have seen the value in bringing these complementary companies together. But what we did indeed was not, we signed it and then we made up our minds how to integrate these companies. We made the whole post-merger integration, the so-called post-merger integration pre-signing. So we discussed with all these five companies, with the heads of all these five companies, what's the value of the individual company? How are you going to reinvest? For which clients will you be responsible? For which offering will you be responsible? What are the incentives? What's the car policy? Where is the headquarter? And stuff like that. And so we created a kind of, let's say, a post-merger integration handbook, an organization handbook, let's call it like that, where we basically discussed strategy, organization, incentives, and all that stuff. So there was a kind of, let's say, a roadmap how to get there, but there was even a clear understanding, and all the owner of the smaller companies, they all signed basically this, not only the contract, they signed their willingness to work along the roadmap we outlined in this organizational handbook. And this was a super successful story because this created not only a new company in bringing together these five companies, this was even the platform to be able, I guess, to acquire seven or nine more in the course of the business. And DivaE really succeeded. They proved that the ideas were right. Of course, there were some bumps on the road. By the way, the best idea we then had was that Tilman Au, who was just, let's say, the inspirational guy at the very beginning, he became the CEO because he was so much in the business and he was so much convinced about his own concept that he basically was, we were asking him, why are you not investing? Why are you not going there? Why are you not putting your money where your mouth is? And I guess he made a great journey with us. And so we are now happy to hand over the company because we strongly believe that this is now the right partner for the next step because DivaE became very international. They are able to deliver their services all around the globe, but then now they are making the next step.
So, you know, many of our listeners are having a finance background. So my question also related to DivaE. By the way, we were supporting Tilman on the journey with some consulting support at that time. But looking at the role of a CFO in this play, how do you look at this CFO role? What do you see as a function of finance? How does finance need to contribute to the value case?
The CEO needs to get an enabler on board for realizing his strategic ideas. And this is, of course, the role of a COO as well, but even more of a CFO, because the CFO has to deliver a toolbox to create in an ever-changing model, ever-changing business, because it's getting more international and stuff like that. We are making add-on acquisitions, so it's changing on a day-to-day basis. He needs to be able to deliver the right transparency, the right KPI dashboard, to be able to get at least a timely access to what we are really doing and how is the company performing, because this is the basis for the this is the transparency we need to take the right decisions. And it's not only about taking the right decisions in which areas, products, regions, services we want to be active in. It's even the right decisions, what's the right financing framework for it. Mm-hmm. And we always want to put a financing structure in place which is able to support the growth ambitions and of the company and not limiting the growth potential of the company. And this is very difficult because you need to get money at work. You need to get a very efficient financing at work, but it needs to have certain buffers if things may take longer, if not delivering what we expected, and this is of course the work of the CFO. So he's the sparring partner of the CEO, and this is a much more important role. And this is, by the way, even difficult if you had an entrepreneur who was the number one, who was basically steering the company by his bank account, because for him this was just enough to get the right transparency, managing the company along a certain cash understanding. And now he's getting at eyes level, a sparring partner. This is even a kind of transition these kind of CEOs sometimes needs to take, because they need to understand that they have now somebody next to them, which make them even stronger.
Okay, I have one more question, Gori, at your end. Since you talked about CFO, let's talk about CEO. Could you paint a profile of an ideal CEO for you?
The ideal CEO are guys like Till Eberle, who is active at Boards & More, are guys like Till Manauer at DIVAE, for example. And why these are, and these are just examples, and why these are, these guys are so deep in their product, so deep in their offering. They are acting as entrepreneurs. They are taking decisions quickly. They are no bullshitters. They are, they have no ego. Of course, they have a certain personality and they are characters, and rightfully so. But at the end, it's always the company which is in their center of mind and in their thinking 24/7, I would say. And you feel that they are not just managers. You feel that they are married also to their company, which is good. And this makes these companies successful. But only if they don't mix it up with, I don't know, with the old fashioned CEO who has a certain ego, is difficult to deal with, because if things are changing, they might bring the company in the wrong direction, or they might sometimes even not be able to hand over certain responsibilities to managers around them. And I strongly believe that the most successful entrepreneurs and CEOs are people who understand their own limits, and without fearing that they are giving something away from themselves, they just can improve themselves if they surround them by smart people. And I guess this is the miracle of a lot of successful entrepreneurs, that they always understood I might be good in a certain field, but if I want to make my company grow, if I want to be successful, I need to create a platform to attract the most talented people. And the more I can add of them, the more I grow, even in my own personality, with my own character. And this is to see these guys as an inspiration. And this is what all these people I just mentioned did.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue, actually, Sven, to also looking back at your career and your current career. So, Sven, you have been in consulting. You have been in the deals consulting for many years. You had been in a senior partner position here before you switched to private equity. Now you're, let's say, in the end game with private equity partnership. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What were very important steps in your career? Let's start with this.
I said it earlier, it's all about reverse engineering, and then it makes all sense as in career advice. Yeah. No, I really believe I always have an anecdote. If we all studied BWL here in Germany at these times, and if we recall how we went to university and how we basically met other colleagues, it was very segmented in the people who started marketing or strategy or these kind of esoteric stuff, and the others who were basically specializing in controlling, financing.
Who were in the numbers.
Yeah, who were in the numbers. Yeah. And these people went not only to different professors and had different specializations. They did not meet at the same parties. They were not interested in the same activities. And they were even looking at each other, I would say, in a certain, not super respectfully, but disrespectfully. And we, at the very beginning, and nobody really understood how this all sums up and can really create value. And what we often see is, of course, things have changed. But if we look, if we open the window and look in the so-called German Mittelstand, I guess there are not many bankers, controllers, bookkeepers out there who were able to build up companies successfully. Yeah. These are always people who have been driven by a certain idea about the product. They had an idea about strategy. They were convinced that they can create a new market and do things differently. And they were then able to hammer this idea home in different ways. And now the financial industry, the private equity comes from the different angles, the pure financial services industry, and was created from this angle. And so a lot of bankers, bookkeepers, due diligence, financial due diligence guys stepped in. And of course, rightfully so, but the idea is now, how can this grow together? And this is the difficulty, because everybody of us has a certain strength. And normally, if we come into problems, we rely on our strength, and we are not open to enter in new areas. We are not open to for new experiments. And but for me, it's the combination of strategy, the combination with organization, with finance, with controlling, with psychology, which is even more esoteric for some people, because at the end of the day, it's all about the motivation of people, about what they are fearing, what is motivating them. And if you are able to combine these different aspects, then I think this is a very good layer for really being a successful investor, not only who is not able to do a good investment, but who is even able to manage a company or support a management team through the different stages of an investment. And so if I look back at my career, I'm very thankful that I started indeed in private equity. I started in private equity, but it was at these times private equity was not even, nobody knew how to spell it. And even due diligence was a kind of a new fancy word. Mm-hmm. But it was basically a bunch of three people. One was coming from a very wealthy family. Another one was coming from an aristocratic family. He knew everybody, had a tremendous network and was able to open a lot of doors. And the third one had the know-how. So I called him the Three Musketeers. Yeah. He was a former McKinsey partner. And these three guys joined forces and invested private and family money into turnaround situations. Mm-hmm. And I was with them for about 2 years. But in parallel to my job, I wanted to finish my doctorate, and they offered me a contract, 80% salary and only 4 days working. And with the 80% salary, it worked out very well, but not with the 4 days. Yeah. And so I decided to leave because I wanted to finish my doctorate. I decided to make a step aside and said, okay, guys, I'm now going to leave. And I got offered a position at Wiesel One Partner, which is a consultancy focused on the German Mittelstand, mm-hmm. or not Mittelstand, focused on German family owned businesses. Mm-hmm. And for me, this was very interesting, to work, with people who were basically spending their own money. It was a complete different situation. So understanding even what's the difference between a managed company and a family owned business. Mm-hmm. And I, at the beginning, I wanted to stay with Wiesel Huber just until I would have completed my doctorate. But then I liked it so much to work for these family-owned businesses that I stayed there for 9 years or so. And in consulting. So this was basically strategy consulting. Sometimes it was even restructuring, but with a different label probably. And I think this was a great time to lay the ground for understanding how a Mittelstands company really works. And after that, I worked for, this was even the way, because these family-owned businesses always had the need for a certain, for certain financing events came up. We want to grow. We need to restructure. We want to pay out family members we don't get along anymore. And this created the corporate finance angle within Wiesel Huber and Partner, basically. But then I decided to go for Deloitte to do the business there, because it was my ambition to do this for a more global company. And there I had the same clients on the one hand, but I was able to add private equity and larger corporates to my client portfolio. And so I came even in contact with the private equity environment, and I liked it so much. And I liked it so much, even having board seats in different companies, because I was always feeling a bit regretful when we signed a deal at the notary. We had so much ideas, but other people were able to realize them, that I said, okay, let me again move to the other side of the table. And I think these experiences of working on financing and investment for mid-cap companies, for entrepreneurs depending on the decisions of a larger corporate, and then they spun off their businesses. This gives you so much insights in different life cycles and situations of the people managing companies, gives me a lot of experiences to be able to maneuver in this situation of the day.
So if we summarize it, that means you say it is important to get this broad, let's say, experience and then put it together in an entrepreneurial environment, if that is possible in the end,
because then you have this
capital perspective included.
Indeed.
Right?
And I'm, of course, it's a kind of reverse engineering, but I strongly believe a company is successful until it's able to sell the products in its specific markets successfully with a high margin. Yeah. And of course you have to have the transparency, but at the end of the day, it's a very entrepreneurial task. And therefore, this is one reason why I believe strategy matters much more than just numbers. Of course, but the numbers must be right and you have to have access. Don't get me wrong, but if the strategy and the idea is not the right one, a messed up company, a messed up strategy will never become a good one because you have a good CFO in place. A good strategy can be very successful if the right CFO is supporting it, but not the other way around. And therefore, it's very, and for me, I strongly believe it's much easier to get mentally access from a a more insecure environment. If you are able to maneuver and being open with this insecure environment in terms of strategy, it's easier then to get the understanding why numbers are important and how you look at the numbers and how you believe in them. And it's much more difficult if you are from the numbers, if you're coming from the numbers and you believe that 1 + 1 is always 2, to get in this insecure environment and then discussing about strategy. We experience that very often, that younger colleagues are struggling much more in making the step from financing to strategy than colleagues from strategy to finance. And even to psychology, because how to deal with people, it's not only a numbers game. What are you going to discuss with a CEO when it's getting really important? You discuss strategy, and you discuss how to make his succession successful, and how to make a transition successful. And of course you discuss how to measure it, but getting the conviction that this is the right step, this is what makes a company successful at the end of the day, and get the people behind it and motivated. And therefore, I believe digging deeper into Excel is necessary, but it's not notwendig, aber nicht hinreichend to be successful.
Yeah. But this sounds very much like you need this entrepreneurial mindset. You need to understand how to build the value case, not just to track it, right? So this brings us basically, and we could talk for hours, Sven, that's for sure, but this brings us basically to our last question, which I would like to relate to this entrepreneurial spirit, because is there any kind of book or podcast that you would suggest that can help to give insights in such an entrepreneurial spirit? Or is there any kind of piece of art that you would say people should take a look at and understand it, because it translates something like this?
The most attractive podcast or gory is of course yours to listen to, which gives a lot of fruitful insights. I would say, we talked about Herbert Hensler before. Herbert Hensler is a great guy. He's the former head of, he created consultancy, being the head of McKinsey here in Germany. And he published a very nice book, which is worth reading. But even older management books like Michael Porter gives nice insights, because he has a kind of, let's say, structured approach, how to look at competition, markets, and its segments, how to make the right segmentations, which gives cool toolboxes even and inspirations how to look at these important kind of stuff. And of course, I would say, whenever you have the possibility to discuss with experienced people how to read an information memorandum, whenever you get it in your hands, gives a lot of very good insights how to really read between the lines and in a very hands-on way.
Sounds like what was right in the past might be still valid for today and for the future.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you. This was amazing. And I'm glad we are gradually moving into the PE world, because you're basically looking at a whole bunch of different perspectives and insights compared to the corporate public sector company CEOs that we've talked to.
Yeah, and then we can say this was a kickoff, and we will have more to come on the CEO level, more on the strategy piece, and Sven was highlighting it, and there's also more coming from the private equity. So to our listeners, thank you very much for listening to us, and I hope you get many great insights and you've learned a lot, and we do look forward to speak to you very soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Sven. Thank you.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by WHU Ottobeisheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.